Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Another Rahalastapa book club. Very excited to be talking to Harriet Gibson about her book, Is This Okay? Hello, Harriet.
Hello, Richard.
Are you all right?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Good. Oh, you know, I'm all right, given everything else. So given all that you have to do. So look, this book is sort of terrifying and funny and fantastic. I thought it was good. I actually thought it might go darker than it did in the early passages. Do you want to tell us first of all a bit about yourself and what you've done before and who you are?
Yeah, of course. So I've been a journalist for just over 15 years. I started out at MTV and I've been a music journalist for various places like The Fly, which is sadly deceased, and then Enemy, Q. And I worked at The Guardian for 8 years as an editor and a writer. But I've primarily focused on writing about musicians and comedians. And this is my first stab at doing something in my own voice and about my own life. I'm wondering why you thought it was terrifying. I'm now worried.
Well, because I thought, like, because it's sort of, it's about parasocial relationships. And I kind of thought when you started talking about, being interested in celebrities, but then working as a journalist, I thought, well, this could go, I mean, it goes to some mildly dark places, but I thought it could go like somewhere darker than it
does. I was going to murder someone. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, not that you're going to murder someone, but because it's about, it's an interesting subject, that the kind of online relationships and the relationships we have with people we don't know. And obviously from my point of view, as someone who's been in the public eye, I sometimes experience that the other way around as well, so that people who I don't know feel they know me, or people, I don't know, and because the sort of work I do is very much like, hey, we're all part of a gang, I can completely understand that, and I want to encourage that in a way, but every now and again someone will take that a little bit too far or misunderstand the relationship. So though I think yours is mainly for you, it's mainly a sort of fantasy and personal journey rather than you doing anything weird. But I thought that would be quite a good horror story about a music journalist who meets all the musicians that she's fantasized about and then, you know, does unpleasant things to them.
I was going to say, I can't think of anything worse than actually like making anyone feel intimidated. So I've always kept these fantasies very private. And I know exactly what you mean, that kind of the way that social media has allowed people to feel as if you're part of one group. And I've never actually directly contacted anyone that I've been in love with apart from Deliciously Ella. And she was very kind. But I left it at that. One message, that's all it was. Yeah.
So tell us about what prompted you. Obviously, you'd written about a few of these, the things that happened in the book. It is a very personal book, and it's sort of a biography, autobiography of a certain aspect of your life. And a lot of it, certainly the second half, it becomes sort of very personal and visceral in some places. What made you think there was that it had to be a book, and how did that progress?
Well, I was in a bit of a precarious position professionally because I used to work at The Guide, and The Guardian sadly closed it while I was on my maternity leave. And I kind of felt that I was at a bit of a crossroads professionally, where the writing that I wanted to do, which isn't very serious, it's often quite sort of irreverent and silly, there wasn't so much of a place for it anymore in modern print and online journalism. And I didn't really know where I would want to go beyond The Guardian. And I went for a sort of misery walk one evening, and I was sort of berating myself. I was thinking, what do you actually know about what, like, beyond just sort of random facts about people you barely know online? And what have you actually dedicated your life to other than staring at people on the internet? And I sort of had an epiphany in that moment of self-loathing that I could actually turn my weakness into my strength. And, you know, the more I spoke to friends and I kind of probed online about it, I realised that so many of us are spending all our time online, but we rarely talk about what we're actually doing, and what we're actually doing is staring at people. And I think there's often a value in exploring what we're actually looking for, because it is a waste of time, and I hate that I've spent 20 years doing it. But at the same time, I think it's really revealed to me a lot about my desires in life, my coping mechanisms, which is escapism massively.
Yeah.
And what makes me feel really rubbish about myself. I was a really jealous young girl, and that totally consumed me when the internet came along. Yeah, I suppose it's just adding a kind of more introspective gaze onto internet culture, which is something that I've evolved with as well as evolving as a woman.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting because your whole life really, I mean, for me, I remember the internet arriving, and I remember sort of getting involved quite early on in it. But for you, it's sort of certainly all that you'll remember in your life, it's always been there. So it is, you know, I think that it's great to see someone write about that. I think your experiences will be common to a lot of people, in terms of, you know, the way probably a lot of people slightly cyberstalk people or can't keep their eyes off, you know, potential partners or ex-partners, Instagram or whatever, or social media. I mean, that is interesting because even for me, I think by the time I met my wife, sort of social media was just sort of taking off. But I think I remember a couple of girlfriends I might have Googled just before I went on a date with them or whatever. I remember once a girl I ended up going out with was searching for something on my computer. She sent me something and found these photos of her that I'd accidentally downloaded. They're just of her face.
No.
But it was quite sweet because whenever I'd first searched her, because I thought, who is it? You know, I'd obviously just accidentally downloaded some photos of her. So luckily we were going out, and luckily she found it sweet rather than intensely creepy. But I didn't have much experience of the kind of thing that you did. But you know, I think for someone who's, you're obviously were and maybe still are quite insecure. I mean, you're very honest in this book about your insecurities, your sort of you know, you feel like you're a very good writer, so I don't think you should be feeling these things, but you feel like you've got imposter syndrome, I suppose, which I think we all feel a little bit. The honesty, you know, it is, it's sort of breathtakingly honest at times, and but I think most people will have done, certainly the fantasy elements of it would have thought similar stuff.
Yeah, I am insecure. I think that as I've gotten older, I went through the menopause in my late 20s, and going through that, there's something about that hormonal shift into the menopause. I'm sort of 8 years into it now, that does sort of remove some of that sort of timidity that I did have when I was younger. So this book is like absolutely jam-packed with self-deprecation and a lot of self-loathing. And even when I read it back now, which I did this morning, I'm kind of quite shocked and upset. I've kind of stayed away from rereading it because the person who wrote it, you know, that person a year ago had a real like tunnel vision and real intention and like a kind of confidence in itself to actually be able to put it out that in that confident way. Like, I think it does require a bit of confidence to lay it on the line like that. So I don't think I am too insecure these days, but it is quite, yeah, it does sort of take my breath away when I hear myself talking so negatively and relentlessly. The book is also fun though, hopefully.
It is very funny, and yeah, I mean but I think that on it is the honesty of it is that's, you know, it's a very stand-up comedian impulse, I think, to the, if you're honest with the audience, and it's something that I've done a lot in my comedy and my podcast, I think if you're honest about your own failings and the stupid things you've done and the ridiculous things you've done, it does help other people to go, oh yeah, well, yeah, that's the human condition. I don't think your experience is universal, but I think there's elements of it that will be universal. I found it quite interesting as a comedian, you know, who for journalists can sometimes be not quite the enemy, but certainly there's a battle line drawn up. I found it quite an interesting look into what I imagined might be the case with a lot of cool journalists, in that they're sort of all kind of, I mean, you're very honest about that, about kind of, you know, writing bad reviews of people to try and make a name for yourself and then realizing they hurt people and feeling bad about it.
Oh my good Lord.
Which is really nice it's really interesting to read that and to know that often, you know, the enemy time, when times I was in the enemy would have been before you were there. And you mentioned Johnny Cigarettes, which is a name I hadn't heard for a while that I remember. But, you know, we were fated a little bit by the enemy, but you kind of, I always suspected, as you know, as sure was the case for myself as well, that, you know, you're trying to be cooler than you are and you're trying to fit in, but you're equally trying to stand out. It's a horrible kind of self-persecuting world to be in as a young 20-something, I suppose.
Yeah, I've never met a group of more sort of socially incompetent people than journalists generally. I mean, arts journalists, but also just war reporters, any genre. I'm always just shocked that they're the people capable of extracting information from very talented people. It's almost like their awkwardness is the thing that allows for the information to be dragged out of the person they're interviewing, because they're sort of quite comfortable sitting in that silence. I would say in the noughties particularly, it was just the Wild West, wasn't it? There was no consideration for anyone's mental health or anyone's safeguarding. It was a kind of it was a very macho boys' club of who can say the rudest thing. I remember sitting down in someone's house trying to review a Reading Festival set, and I said to them, "What's the worst thing I could say?" And they said, "Oh, you could describe them as an abortion." And I was like, "Oh yeah, I'll write that." And I would never do that now. Not only because I'd be terrified of being cancelled on Twitter for sort of demeaning abortions, but because it's just so mean. And especially now I've written a book, I know what's involved in making something and how precious it is and how you always feel misunderstood. And it's been a very humbling experience. Very humbling experience. No one has been really nasty about my book, but one person has diagnosed me with a litany of quite severe mental disorders, which I wasn't expecting. So I'm like, oh, you know, the spirit of being a nasty vitriolic person sort of lives on in a new way in journalism. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a terrible thing when you have worked hard on something. You know, I found that with sometimes you get a review from someone and you think, I mean, I was called the worst comedy experience of 2005 by the Daily Telegraph at the end of the year about my Edinburgh show, which was actually not, you know, it was an interesting show. I could see why people wouldn't like it. But you kind of think, what? I mean, I was sort of chuffed because it was the Daily Telegraph and the guy had been so angry about the show that he'd waited that long. But you kind of think, how can that guy who reviews all comedy kind of pick on that show and not go, at least he was trying to do something interesting with that? So you're aware that sometimes there's, you know, it's like when people comment on Twitter about you, kind of think, I've realized often that when people get upset about something you've done, it's because what you're talking about directly affects them in some way, so they get much more kind of viscerally upset about it, or you've done something without realizing that's upset someone. But yeah, and sometimes people are just trying to be mean. Yeah, but that's true of, it's certainly true of me in my 20s as a comedian. There's loads of jokes I would have done in my 20s that I wouldn't do now. You know, that's part of the growing process. And that, and music journalism, well, it isn't anymore, but it, you know, it should be the prerogative really of people in their 20s mainly. So yeah, it's going to have that. It's everything.
I really enjoy, and it is nasty, but I do still really enjoy reading a kicking. Like if someone gets one star, I do quite enjoy it. Read that experience of reading it. But you've got to pick on someone who is absolutely industrial. Like, you know, you can slag off Beyonce, but if you're like an artist who's playing their first gig at Dingwalls at like 4 p.m. on a Saturday, just leave them alone. And I write in the book about this band that I decide to be critical of, and the front person sends me a DM at 3 a.m. explaining how much it's hurt him. And it was a real moment in time of realizing people are fragile and I'm not capable of being that ruthless.
And it's, I mean, it just made, you know, by the by, it sort of just made me think of the weird relationship between journalists and the people they're reviewing and interviewing, because it's never going to be an even relationship, and it's never going to be quite honest, because the, you know, you're aware as being interviewed that you can't piss the other person off, or you have to guard yourself a little bit against the other person, however much you feel you trust them. So and it's, there's a brilliant Tim Minchin song where he lays into his one star reviewer called Phil Doust, that he's written this awful reply song to, which but it's funny because he does exactly what you're not meant to do, and it's one of the funniest things there's ever been. But you know, as someone who's being reviewed, you can't do that, because that would annoy the person for a review down the line. So it's a weird position of power that you have as a journalist, but it's sort of like built on this, you know, built on a sort of negative things. I found that very interesting, and that sort of does come across in the book. But it's about, you know, it is about so much more. And as you say, there's lots of funny stuff in it, and lots of, I mean, look, again, as a parent, lots of slightly worrying things, because of, you know, obviously you're quite young when you sort of found MSN Messenger and these group chats and stuff, and you were sort of, you know, sort of talking to adults as if you were an adult, and that's the kind of terrifying thing as a parent, as you'll increasingly find as your child.
I hope my son reads my book and never wants to log on ever again, because he's so horrified. That's the dream. This is kind of a warning sign to my little boy, this book.
I mean, I'm obsessed with I'm not really obsessed with looking up old girlfriends or their partners or anything like that, but I am online all the time, and you do sort of, you know, and I'm either online or playing games on my phone and wasting so much of my time. But I think, again, as a writer, possibly you'd need to do it. Possibly there's something about empty, you know, having your brain go blank so that you can write when you need to. But it is a, you know, it's, I mean, it's 20 or 30 years now, isn't it? But it's a weird thing that we have this resource that has so much information in it, which is amazing in some ways and then just terrible in others. And And especially if you're the kind of person who, as you are or as you were, that can't quite resist stepping away.
Yeah, it was really hard writing the book because I really wanted to log out of all my accounts, but I really needed to use them to research my past life. So I was chronically online while writing about the dangers of being chronically online. And I have to say, one of the hardest things is looking at the way in which you used to communicate with people when you were even a year ago, but you know, when you're 17, retracing Hotmail email threads, either I'd email sort of a prospective employer that I wanted work experience with, or I'd be emailing a boy that I fancied, and the absolute boisterousness and just insanity that I used to write these messages to people as if I was really, I think I must have been told just like go in really confident, really brash. That's how you get what you want. And I'd nag people. And it wasn't appropriate at all. So confronting all those old messages was disgusting on Hotmail. I don't recommend anyone does that. But then even Facebook updates from the early noughties. I mean, there's some real tragic attempts at being a comedian. And it's just kind of the whole thing was a really disgusting humiliating experience. But yeah, when you sort of say about kind of focus, I think one of the things I hate sort of wanging on about why the internet's bad, because everyone knows it's bad, but I just think what we've lost is like the resting period that you have in between work and being with your friends or family and socializing. Sometimes I feel that I use the internet as a quick break, but actually it's just loading my brain full of more stress and information. So I never ever feel that rested anymore, I think. And I certainly find that when I'm working really hard and then I have a quick 5 minutes, you know, it's sort of doubling the amount of exhaustion that I already have as a person. And it's really frustrating. I think I need to take up like fidget spinning or something else.
Yeah, maybe.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
And so, like, there are a couple of, two or three celebrities, I suppose, you're obsessed with in this book. And Chris Martin, I wouldn't say I know him, but I've met Chris Martin a few times. So, and I could let him know about the book if you would like him to read it. I didn't really realise who he was when I met him. And I knew he'd done, like, Yellow. But I hadn't realised quite how big a deal was. He's a friend of Al Murray's, who I was writing with. So I've played Trivial Pursuit with Chris Martin, and every time he landed on History, we sang Yellow at him. And I went to the minicab office with him after that, and we sat in the minicab office. And the next time I saw him, I'd just been to Australia And I'd seen his CD in Australia. And I said, wow, mate, you're doing pretty well. I saw your CD in Australia. And he went, yeah, because they were like a massive band that I hadn't how massive they were. So, you know, I could probably get. Do you think he's going to see this book? Because there's a big fantasy element where you end up in a toilet at, is it a disabled toilet in Glastonbury or something like that, where you end up together? Mm. I hope it's a fantasy.
Just
I
assumed a it celebrity was a fantasy. Party. Yeah. Well, a lot of people who've read it have gone, oh, it took me quite a while to realise that we just slipped into a fantasy because very abruptly my husband dies and this is in the fantasy. And Chris is there to rescue me and he takes me to his 5-story townhouse to look after me because I'm a widow and it's Christmas. And there's an incident in which Gwyneth Paltrow turns up and is charming the Christmas party taking place at Chris Martin's house, and she naturally has a bit of animosity towards me because I'm sleeping in her daughter Apple's room, and I won't spoil anything else, but it's quite sort of sexually repulsive depending on how you feel about Chris Martin and his chest hair. But there's, you know, a lot of stuff happens. There's a big murder at the end, but that was my favorite thing I've had to write. And I suppose I want to ask you, as someone who knows Chris incredibly well, how do you think he would respond to it? Because I've watched lots of interviews with him and I think he's very funny and very self-aware, but do you think maybe it's a step too far?
I think he's got quite a good sense of humor. I think he would sort of be, I think he'd be flattered.
Yeah,
there is, quite nice.
He does seem nice, and I feel like there's a lot of you know, compliments in there about his ability as a front man and a, you know, as an aesthetic being. But there's some things I say about his performance as a lover that I worry that he might not appreciate that much, even though it's fabricated. He might have wanted a slightly more complimentary write-up on the fancy
maybe
show.
I would have thought that he you know, he probably gets a lot of this, though. Like, I think, you know, there'll be a lot of stuff online about this. There'll be a lot of people sending him more than fantasies, I'm sure. There'll be people sending him all sorts of stuff if he's got any kind of online presence at all. So, you know, I think he could probably cope with it. Mm-hmm. But it might, you know, if your husband to die and to get into a relationship with him, it might. If that came up just the day before your wedding, it might. Might make him think twice.
No, I don't want my husband to die. I think.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Okay. Yeah. No, I think maybe it's best that we leave it for now in terms of sending it to him. But then, you know, somewhere along the line, it might boost sales a bit if Chris were to put it on his Instagram. That could be quite handy.
Yeah. So, I think it would be interesting to see that. So maybe, hopefully, yeah. Somewhere along the line. I think like the Deliciously Ella stuff is, for people who don't know who Deliciously Ella is, can you explain who Deliciously Ella is?
Yeah, of course. She's a well-being influencer who made her name as someone who was formerly ill but made herself better because she just sort of ate quinoa and nut butter. And she has had a lot of success. She's actually heir to the Sainsbury's brand, heiress rather, but she's kind of sidelined that. I actually think she has some amazing recipes and I'm very pro her as a figure in sort of healthy eating. But I very much got swept away with her lifestyle brand when I was pregnant, because being pregnant, it was the first time I'd had to actually look after my body in a way that was completely supervised, very regulated. I was eating for another human being rather than kind of being a bit slapdash and often restrictive in the way that young women aren't necessarily always that kind to their bodies. And so I looked to her as a kind of guru. And the sad thing about that is she had a really beautiful birth. It was just sort of pan pipes, candles, hypnobirthing. The baby sort of slipped out when she coughed and then... they breastfed into oblivion, and then she felt really sexy and beautiful the next day. And my birth, on the other hand, wasn't quite as sort of cute as that. And I had this absolutely vitriolic envy towards her experience, because I think a lot of women feel like they've been robbed of something quite profound when the birth has been nasty. So I use her in the book as a kind of that kind of compare and despair thing. I put her birth schedule down blow by blow. So the contractions began, she lit some candles, whereas I kind of put on a four-part Channel 4 a drama series about Robbie Coltrane being a paedophile. And just from there, it's just everything that she does, I do very differently. And I use it kind of actually as a method to talk about the birth itself, because it was very traumatic and I still sort of struggle with it today. But I don't hope she's not offended by that, because she's just living her life and trying to promote her brand. But I do find it very upsetting when people have had lovely experiences with giving birth. And I don't know if that makes me a bad person or not.
I don't think so. I think, you know, I again, empathise with it, having viewed a couple of births which is traumatic enough on its own. Certainly my son's birth was not as traumatic as yours. I know you had some issues, but it all happened very quickly and there weren't enough staff, and my wife hadn't had her drugs, and I knew I was going to be in a lot of trouble for not having fought her corner more. So I'm still kind of quite traumatised by that. And I think it is weird when you read, like, you know, people saying, oh, breastfeeding is wonderful and easy, or birth is incredible. It's a difficult thing that social media puts up, because obviously for some people, birth can be slightly easy. Catherine Ryan was saying she wanted to go back to work 2 hours after the last one. And you kind of think, you know, that's fine for her. But then where does that leave the rest of us that wouldn't be possible for? So again, it is this interesting phenomenon that I think in the past you would have either just assumed everyone went through the same thing, or you wouldn't really have known, or you would talk to your friends and heard about stuff. But if you have someone having a perfect life on Instagram, it's very easy to believe that that's completely true, when it might not always be, and for it to affect you. So I think the book's great for that.
I'm very sort of against the romanticization of motherhood in general and it being this sort of beautiful. I mean, it is a gift. And for someone who is infertile, it's absolutely even more of a gift that I managed to conceive through donor egg. But at the same time, it's really brutal. And I want people to be conscious of that. Like, I don't want, and there's so much shame around finding it hard and disgusting, and just not 3.5 years in, I'm like, you know, physically and mentally still not recovered from it. And I think a lot of people should be more conscious of it. And I think the deliciously other thing, while she was just trying to promote a good birth, I think what it comes down to a lot of the time is like sort of bragging, doesn't it? It's like someone talking about how their childhood was brilliant. And you know, like, sometimes you just got to appreciate that not everyone has had a nice time, and maybe you shouldn't talk about it.
Yeah, but that's the, you know, that's the problem with social media in a nutshell, though, isn't it? That it is everyone putting forward the best of their life, and then for anyone who is not feeling part of the gang or any, which is probably most people who are using the internet a lot, and anyone who is, you know, feeling self-conscious, and again, I think it must be most people. I think even the people who seem very confident, again, as your book shows a little bit, you know, those people who think they're confident and cool are actually worried underneath and terrified that they're going to be revealed as frauds and shams. So it's the nice thing about the internet and about books and about you know, comedy is that people can be honest about their own experiences. I still do find it kind of, you know, when you're talking about your own career and your progress through journalism, you sort of seem to have no, but you know, you must have had a little bit more belief than you're letting on, or at certain times, or you, I don't say how you could have, you know, you were progressing and things were going well and you were getting jobs, and yet your sort of inner monologue was telling you didn't deserve any of it, or that there were better people or the people you were jealous of. But you were still getting these incredible jobs. You know, I mean, to most people, you were up there with the, if you got a job at The Guardian, and a good job at The Guardian, that's like an incredible achievement.
Yeah, I think getting that first job at The Guardian, I remember that feeling when I got told, and it was just the most It was just a beautiful experience. For some reason, and probably, you know, something to do with school or a teacher or being humiliated at some stage of my life, I've really small opinion of my mental capabilities. And even this morning, rereading the book, I was like, you sick piece of shit. It's such a loud volume, that negative voice. But I'm working on reducing it somewhat. I mean, obviously, I do think I have been able, you know, I love writing, and writing this book was, and just anyone liking it has been a hugely validating experience. But I think the issue with my career and the timing of it is that it has coincided with that thing where you have to put work up and then someone leaves a comment under it. And in those very early days, I didn't know that you weren't meant to look. You know, in 2005, that discourse about trolls and all that wasn't really there yet. So I'd sort of naively had this kind of pure relationship with the internet where I'd write this thing about a band, and it was trying to be funny and playful, and you know, it wasn't very formal writing. It was quite chatty, and underneath it would be some guy saying, this is the worst thing I've ever read. And that stayed, you know, it really stays with you, as I'm sure you've experienced with like your criticism and whatever through the years. And that kind of, and I mean, when you get up to The Guardian, that's a whole new tier of, of below the line commenters, because the worst thing is they are really clever and they do make some really valiant points. There's been so many times I've looked and gone, oh yeah, you are all right. I think the problem I have is I really agree and I take on people's criticism. I never go, no, you're wrong, I'm really great. I go, yeah, that's true. I need to try harder.
I think that's a common thing, and to not to accept praise or to not notice the praise. I mean, again, I think like it certainly bothered me in the past. Those sort of things. But then I also, you know, I started just asking people when, you know, like if I put an interview up and people say, I hate this person, you kind of think, why, Bob, why are you feeling the need to say it? Because it sort of says something, it says more about you that you've, but you know, you could, most people would go, oh, I don't like that person, therefore I won't watch that one, or I won't comment on it. It takes a certain type of person to go, I feel it's very important that everyone knows my opinion. And a very sort of self-centered person to think, I need to proclaim this because otherwise this will continue. You know, it's like all I can do with my podcast is have people on that I think are good or I think will be good. And if you disagree, then set up your own podcast and interview different people. But it's, you know, it's sort of a crazy thing to do to go, oh, no, not this person. Well, you know, it's one, and I think as a comedian, you do start to realize it. Some people don't, but you start to realize, like, A, you're never going to please everybody. And if you were pleasing everybody, that would also be quite bad. So, you know, you're going to annoy people. And often, I think, for reasons that are way beyond your control. So it might be someone who doesn't like you because they don't want a female journalist, or it might be someone because they're in love with Chris Martin and they want to have him to themselves. Or it might be someone who's, you know, who's had a worse experience at childbirth or whatever it is, that, you know, it's sort of, you've got to understand that there. And I think this book does, you know, I think this book's really important and great because I think it does make you start thinking of things from other people's perspectives and, you know, and start thinking, okay, well, maybe journalists are human beings underneath. So maybe people commentating on journalist work are themselves, there's something going on there. And I think because we're not on it, people generally aren't honest about their failings. I think this what makes this book great, and also like makes you feel slightly sad as a reader, because you know you're being so honest that makes us feel better about our own failings and our own worries about ourselves. But you also think, but you know, this woman shouldn't be beating herself up. She's clearly got something, and there's clearly a reason she's there. And I guess, you know, but we also know, having worked in, that occasionally somebody gets through who is an imposter. So it makes it very, very difficult, you know, to get rid of that imposter syndrome, which I think most normal people would have imposter syndrome in your situation.
That's the thing. I think the people that I'm most spooked by are the people who are absolutely sure of themselves. And I do meet them quite often. And I don't know if it's just me projecting my own stuff onto them, but I'm like, I'm always hunting for the chink in their armor. And that's kind of what I'm doing when I look at people on the internet. I'm like trying to find their weaknesses to try and make myself feel a bit better about my own. But I think, you know, the more I learn about sort of narcissism and stuff on TikTok, I'm like, actually, there are people out there who are completely sure of themselves, and our brains are all made up completely differently. So maybe I need to stop, you know, thinking everyone is the same as me, when actually there are people who are just quite content with their lot.
I think that's true. People are different. I think most people probably have, you know, a degree of, so, you know, it's a sliding scale, and most people have a degree of doubt and the things you're talking about. And there are definitely, you know, I've definitely met some of these people whose confidence, I mean, Donald Trump is the obvious example. I can think of examples close to home where someone criticizes constantly but can't bear to take any form of criticism or ever admit they're wrong. I've definitely met people like that, Harriet. So, you know, whereas I would be in the position where if I feel I've upset someone, even if I haven't, I'll be apologizing and stressing about it and worrying it for ages, which I think is, I think that's probably more the general experience. But, you know, I just think it's, you know, what's great about this book is the fact that you have been honest about it. And I think a lot of people feel these things and do very similar things to the things you've done and don't admit it even to themselves. So, but I think it's, maybe it's just about finding that balance in the middle of being a little bit less harsh on yourself and a bit less harsh on bands that are going to cry to me in the morning with DMs. But I think, but also the book, because it is, you know, the second half of the book, I suppose, is about, you know, you meeting your husband and things sort of setting down a bit, and then this experience of early menopause and having to go through IVF but still thankfully managing to have your baby, but that being difficult, and you know, it does turn into this more personal story, I suppose. Well, not more personal, but because it is still all personal all the way through. But again, I think it sort of is a little journey of maturing that.
Yeah.
We all go through to some degree of our 20s being much more kind of solipsistic and then having other things to worry about as we get older.
Yeah, yeah. The first half of the book is, have you ever heard of the phrase limerence?
No.
So limerence is like a state of infatuation or obsession with another person. And it's like it's a sort of coping mechanism. So the first half of the book is very preoccupied with those sort of romantic fixations with people, girls, boys, anyone that I want to be near. Whereas the second half of the book becomes way more confronting in terms of my own my body and my brain and the feeling of it sort of combusting at some point. And it's almost like a bit of a pressure cooker, because you've had all this sort of neurosis and anxiety of being a teenager in your 20s and sort of abusing your body in certain ways. Nothing like brutal, but you know, just drinking to oblivion and just not really taking care of yourself properly. And I almost felt like when I got into my 30s, my body was saying, I've had enough now, so I'm going to punish you for this. And I started just crying a lot and having hot flushes, and my brain just, it was like, I don't know, it was sort of moving in slow motion. It was really hard to access any words or information. And it was later diagnosed as the early menopause. And it sort of threw my internet obsession into a new realm, which was less about kind of wanting aspirations and lust, and more about wanting connection and feeling really lonely in my body. Because I think at some stage we all go through something weird with our health or our brains and our lives that sort of isolates you, and you feel it's really hard to tell people what's going on. It was an unusual thing to go through the early menopause, because none of my friends were doing it at the same time. And my mum was, you know, she'd been through it and is very stoic, and it hadn't really affected her that much. So I then retreated to sort of message boards, and I just sort of randomly got obsessed with a guy on a bus that I
Yes.
Had some, I don't know what it was, a draw to. I managed to find his social media just through staring at him for a year, which was one of the best things I've ever accomplished, I think.
That's an extreme, again, that's an unusual, extraordinary story. Again, I think maybe most people wouldn't go that far, but I really empathize with, you know, that being drawn to people and falling for people and falling in love with people and just, I suppose, you're reaching out. You know, it made me remember all those adolescent, and to be fair, well into my 20s and probably 30s, where I was still, you know, trying to find connections with people.
Yeah.
And then how strong they can be, and sometimes it's something real and sometimes it's something fantastical or just, you know, made up. But yeah, you getting obsessed with the man on the bus and tracking him down online is, you know, that could be, again, a book on its own. But again, and that has a nice little connection to your own life as well.
Yeah, it was a fine line writing that one between being introspective and navel-gazy and then actually just being a stalker, you know. I've been really careful about using the word stalk in the book because I really don't want to shame anyone who does it, because I'm not hurting anyone at all. I've never turned up outside anyone's house or touched anyone or sniffed anyone from afar. It's all kind of for my own sort of internal enjoyment. And also I feel like maybe as a girl who's sort of public property from the age of, I don't know, 9 or something, there's a certain like satisfaction and power in being the one who's staring at people. That's kind of how I felt a lot of the time writing about it. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. And I think not many people would be honest enough to admit if they'd done something like along those lines as well. So, I think it's different than some becoming obsessed with someone to the degree that you're destroying their life for certain. But I think it does give you a little glimpse into how you end up going down that road as well, though, I suppose, that you remain in control of it. But it's the book starts with you and a friend observing your next door neighbours through their window and enjoying the sort of soap opera of them basically doing nothing. But just seeing a secret world, and that's, you know, that's the impetus behind it that we all have, that we had all, you know, that's, you know, in a sense, reading your book, I felt like this is, in a way, your reader is your stalker. Admittedly, you've admittedly preferred this and given this information out, but we're all reading a book. That's why I quite enjoyed that element of it, that you're reading it, knowing that we're delving into the personal aspects of your life, and none of us are going, oh, I better back away from this. This is too personal. Oh. So we're all being, you know, we're all fascinated by the minutiae of other people's lives, and we're all potentially exactly the same. So it is interesting how you, I hope that would strike most people that you yourself as the reader are doing the same thing that you are writing about in a lot of ways. Admittedly, with your permission.
Yeah, that's such a nice point. I really like that. I hadn't considered how the book is its own sort of intense voyeuristic exploit, but it is. Yeah. And I wanted to like reveal the very disgusting granular details of my body, even though I know it's like not always nice to read about, but those things that we're often trying to hide about ourselves. So, you know, I know it's a bit of a, well, it was deemed a cliche for a woman to be talking about periods, but, you know, there's a lot of discussion about, you know, stains on beds or wetting myself and wearing a nappy and things that are quite sort of, I don't know if they're taboo, but they're certainly not always nice. But I wanted to like give the reader almost a little bit too much, because I really wanted to I wanted to have the experience of everyone just being in me and what it feels like. Also, after years of sort of centering men in my sort of writing, or just generally wanting to be attractive to men, it's quite nice to write something that is actively disgusting, I think.
Yeah, but you know, equally, it's, I think all those things are, and that idea that women shouldn't write about or that writer, you know, that was always leveled at female comedians that all they did was talk about periods. And A, it was really not true. But also every male comedian would absolutely talk about their cocks and their spunk and everything is, you know, ad infinitum. So it was sort of a way of shutting people up rather than any truth in it. And I think also, you know, everyone needs to know this stuff. And, you know, I think when you have an experience, and I wasn't really aware of early menopause as an idea. You know, menopause is quite a mystery, I think, to most men and maybe even most young women, because it's not something that gets, it seems like just in the last couple of years, more people are talking about it. Bridget Christie's been talking about it. There's been a couple of other things I've seen recently where people have talked about it, but it's not something that I knew very much about. And I wouldn't have, you know, I wouldn't have considered someone going into menopause in their 30s before. So, you know, that I think those things are important, but I think it is, it's obviously who I am a little bit as well, and what I want to do with my stuff. But I think the more we can talk about those issues, even if they're not universal, even if they're 1 in 1,000 people, it's still it's helpful for the people who are going to do the same thing, but it's also helpful for the other people to understand it. So I think this book does all those things. But yeah, I suppose all books are voyeuristic, aren't they, really? All books are us trying to get into the life of a fictional or real person and find out all the messy details about them. So, you know, so I think none of us, anyone who reads a book, can't complain if you stalk them on the bus and found out where they work. It is a charming story, that one, I have to say. It's out of all the stalker stories I've ever read, and out of all the stories of that sort of thing, it's a nice and a distant thing, and it's it never crosses a line. So it's it's very interesting. I mean, the book's full of stuff like that, and it's a very good read. And there's a lot of we've concentrated on more serious aspects of it, but it is very funny as well.
Thank you.
I ask everyone if they're reading anything they would like to recommend. I presume you're quite a reader.
No, I'm not.
Being a journalist.
No, I'm not. I actually find reading really difficult. I know it's quite embarrassing to admit, but I mean, in my teens and 20s, I was too busy having fun to read, and it just never became part of my habits. And then in the last sort of 10 years, I've really loved it. I'm actually reading Jen Began's Big Swiss, which is the novel about a woman who becomes obsessed with another woman. She transcribes therapist notes, and she becomes obsessed with the person that the therapist is talking about. But I really like comedy books. So I've like got all of Harry Hill books, and growing up, I always loved sort of the Adam and Joe book and like stupid little bitty things. I think my attention span's always been terrible, so I like reading small things that are funny.
Yeah, good. Well, I think that's true of me to an extent as well. And doing this podcast about books is an attempt for me to read a bit more. Though I mean, audiobooks are good.
Yeah,
I listen to your book as an audiobook mainly. I have got the copies. I actually kind of, I don't know when I got your book. Your book was sitting on my desk for ages. I don't remember it arriving or who sent it, and it was sitting there for a long time.
It was me.
To the point that, but I don't know how it got into my house. You know, maybe you came into my house and put it on my desk. I don't remember it. I don't remember it arriving. It was there for a long time, and I was looking at it, and then it went somewhere else, and my wife then gave it back to me. So it did feel like I was meant to read this book. So I'm glad that I have read the book.
Thank you.
And it's got, you know, you've got great quotes from a lot of top comedians on the front. Bob Mortimer, Sarah Pascoe, Jamie Dimitri, and Robert Popper all loved your book, which is a terrific start. So yeah, and it's been out, and you've been book touring, and so will there be more? Is there another book in the pipeline?
Yeah, I've started a novel about sort of lust, rage, and middle age. But it's only 20,000 words in, so it's sort of a bit of an amorphous thing at this stage. But I'm going to keep writing, I think.
Good. Yeah. Well, I hope you'll do more factual stuff, but a novel will be very exciting as well. And you can do a novel about you, but you start killing musicians.
All comedians. All comedians.
Comedians could be next. Putting your book in their house. And yeah. Look, it's really nice to meet you. And the book's really great.
Thank you.
And good luck with everything. So do go out and buy Is This Okay? By Harriet Gibson. Thank you very much. Thanks to Chris Evans for his sterling work on this one, which I think the technical difficulties have been my fault, and Ben Evans as well, who does lots of work on the podcast for us. And we'll see you next week.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Thanks for listening. richardherring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.